This is Paul Burnett interviewing Alex Scott for the Global Mining and Materials Research Project. We're here at the TMS meeting in Orlando, Florida, and it's March 18th, 2015, and this is audio file one. So welcome, Mr. Scott. It's great to see you, and we're going to begin at the beginning, and I'll ask you a little bit about where you're from, where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay, Paul. I was born in New Jersey, Elizabeth, New Jersey, my father was a postal inspector, and we had a beach cottage down on the Jersey shore, and they liked the ocean and the beach so much, so my father got transferred down to Monmouth and Ocean County in New Jersey. And so we moved down there when I was in fourth grade, and I was raised at the beach.
Oh, wow.
And spent all my summers on the beach running around with no shoes, having a wonderful experience. Mm-hmm. I was there in New Jersey. We actually ended up living in a resort town called Spring Lake, New Jersey, is where I was raised. Went through school there, and then went to Manasquan High School, and graduated from there.
Okay.
And went off to college then.
Okay. When you went off to the college, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do as a career?
Interestingly enough, probably not. I ended up going to Virginia Military Institute, VMI, in Lexington, Virginia. And I was all set to go to Rutgers, our state university in New Jersey, with some friends. My parents took me down there on spring break to VMI, and I looked at it, and I didn't know what I was getting into there. It was a military college a la like West Point, called the West Point of the South.
Right.
And I said to my parents, my mother said, "It'll make a Southern gentleman out of you." And I was like, "What?" I didn't think anything was, I thought I was pretty cool at the time. Any event, I said to them, "If you'll let me fly," I'd never flown, "if you'll let me fly here, I'll go." Mm-hmm. And they said, "Deal." So that's how I ended up at VMI.
But what year was that?
1959.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a history major there, liberal arts major. And I had a very good experience there. Mm-hmm. It's big on honesty, integrity. The I word, integrity, was beaten into us. And
core
so
values.
I graduated in 1963. Mm-hmm. And at that point, in the last couple of years that I was there, I got interested in psychology. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have many courses in that. So the psychology professor kind of took me under his wing, and he said, "Well, the best thing maybe for you, if you want to look at some schools that might be have personnel and counseling psychology in grad school." And so I did. And interestingly enough, Rutgers University had that. And I went, after I graduated in 59, I went to Rutgers and got a master's in personnel and counseling psychology.
And what was the attraction to psychology for you?
I think the for psychology, it just dealt with people and what motivated people, what interested people, and I just found that interesting for myself to learn more about how people thought, functioned, and those kinds of things. And I think honestly, I always was kind of a people person. I'm very comfortable around people, comfortable meeting people. My son-in-law and a couple of close friends say, "I don't know how you go to the billy house. You can speak to somebody on an elevator. You can go up to somebody you don't had never met and start up a conversation." But I have no issue with that.
It's kind of a native skill that ended up serving you well later in life.
I'd like to think so.
Or, I mean, I'm sure it served you at the time as well.
Yeah. But.
So you completed. Did you do a thesis for your? For your master's?
I did have to write a paper, but it was more practical. We had to do counseling. I was in counseling situations with students, high school students, as a practicum, I guess I would call it, and did that. And then I completed that in the 2 years, and then I had to, because of VMI, ROTC, I was in the military.
Yeah.
And I always joke about my, seriously, about my military career. I wasn't a square peg in a round hole. Because I had a psychology degree of sorts. I was infantry, and I spent 2 years, as I said, 1 year at Fort Gordon in civil affairs, and then, believe it or not, 1966, 67, I spent a year in Vietnam. But I was assigned to psychological warfare, and it was very interesting. I have nothing to say, but and I know a lot of people had a really hard time there.
Yeah.
I had a interesting and rewarding experience,
mm-hmm.
being able to do what I did. I don't want to get into a lot of detail about it, but
sure.
maybe. But we were responsible for writing leaflets, for doing refugee camps
yeah.
for people, and we also did what was called the Chu Hoi program. That was to bring Viet Cong and people into understanding of what democracy was all about.
Mm-hmm.
It was like classes. We ran classes for that.
Yeah, yeah. I won't ask you big details, but I am curious about the kind of, did you have to do cultural analysis? Or was it, if it was psychology, did you have to understand universal human processes in order to do the leaflets, for example?
Yes, well, your question sounds more sophisticated than maybe it was. But we did have to spend time. I spent a number of I'd go out for a week or two at a time with an interpreter and a photographer and live with different tribes, with the Mountain Yard tribes in particular. And if the military was going to do an activity there
yeah.
Of some sort, a military activity, mm-hmm. we would then move those people to a refugee site, set them up to live, then they could go back after they were done.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to understand what they were about, what their needs were,
right.
Their language, their customs, and all those kinds of things. We would document that to make their transitions as easy and as good as possible.
Right, right. So there was an important degree of accommodation.
Exactly.
Because these were pretty wrenching experiences to being moved. And
correct. And
yeah.
they were people, in all candor, that were certainly not very sophisticated
yeah.
in education or lifestyle or anything.
Yeah.
They lived in huts that were built up off the ground. And their livestock and chickens and pigs lived underneath, and they threw their garbage down, and that's
mm-hmm.
what they ate to some degree.
Yeah.
And it was a very different world, but
yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, the mountain yard people and the mountains of central Vietnam are absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of your team, did you work with other psychologists? Was it mostly psychologists, or was it other social sciences like anthropology or sociology?
No, I can't say it wasn't quite that sophisticated. We just did, I was the only, there were two other officers that had the same type of degree that I had that did what I was doing in other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I was stationed in Tu Khoi, which is the central third of Vietnam. So that activity was really, as I explained, it wasn't that sophisticated,
yeah.
keep using that word, sophisticated.
<That's right. laughs> But it was eye-opening for someone who hadn't done a lot of traveling. You had gone to VMI and you got your plane to go there,
yeah.
but this is halfway around the world,
yes,
completely different culture. So, and you had a pretty positive experience doing
yes.
it. And so when you return, it's 1967.
Correct.
So this is the summer of love. And
right.
all of that, and you had this military background. How did you feel returning to the United States and thinking about the next steps in your
yeah.
life?
That was kind of was somewhat interesting, I think, from the standpoint. I was able to do two R&Rs, and I got to go to Hong Kong, and I got to go to Bangkok, and for a week at a time while I was in Vietnam. And I remember thinking to myself, and I would get on a plane in Saigon, fly to Hong Kong, walk around the streets there. Life was normal,
yeah.
beautiful. I'd fly back into Saigon, you get off the plane, and it sounds dramatic, but somebody could shoot you dead, and you're a military casualty,
right.
you know?
Right.
And it's like those worlds going from one to the other, as we can today, and our military do today.
Right.
I mean, it's just, it's two different worlds.
It's
and adjusting to that is difficult. I did not have a difficult adjustment. When I came back in 67, it was sort of the era that I sat down and looked up the Fortune 500 companies and picked 100 of them and wrote a nice cover letter, did my resume or whatever it was, and mailed that out. And I got, fortunately, I got probably 5 to 10 responses, I went on 4 or 5 interviews and made a decision of a career choice, which turned out not to be in the field I was interested in, because the 2 or 3 offers I got in personnel work, is where I kind of ended up, were with American Airlines and Coca-Cola. And both of them wanted me to sit and do union contracts and union negotiation. I was a people person. I just thought, I'm not going to sit up. And they said, oh, you could be up half the night, you know, negotiating a contract and arguing over the fine print. And what? You know, not me. And then my next door neighbor, who was an influence on me, a gentleman who had gone to BMI, called me over one evening and said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm looking at this, looking at that. And I said, okay. He said, I've got something. I want you to go see a friend of mine who works for Hilton Hotels in New York City. And I was in New Jersey, and I thought, oh, you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere.
Sure.
I was gung-ho, honestly, at that stage. And so I went on the interview, and they made me an offer to be a sales rep with Hilton Hotels in New York City. And that's where my first job was in late 67, I think it was November of 1967. And just as selling, working with convention groups and bringing conventions into the Hilton Hotels there.
Okay. So going from, I guess, a vision of individual psychological counseling to large groups of people, large gatherings of people where you have to organize their accommodations and all of that. So how did you adjust to that kind of career? Did you seem to have thrived in it?
I think I adjusted rather easily. I really enjoyed that, because working with working with people and convention groups and showing the hotel and selling the hotel in all candor came relatively easy, and I did pretty well at it, and really enjoyed that work.
Yeah.
And I found it reasonably rewarding, and I could see a career path there at the time, and all that was good.
And did you live in New York? Did you live in Manhattan?
Yes, I couldn't afford to live in Manhattan on what I was making. I don't mind. Well, I shouldn't say how much I made, maybe, but it was pretty meager, but enough. So I had an apartment. I was a huge baseball fan, and I got an apartment out by Shea Stadium because I loved the Mets and the National League. And I lived right across the street from Shea Stadium, an apartment, and I went to almost every home game I could possibly go to for those 3 or 4 years that I lived there.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you worked with convention groups. So it's organizational skills, organization management. Can you talk about how you then transitioned to entering this group of folks?
Sure, it was a little bit strange, maybe, or a little bit lucky, or whatever you might want to call it. As I indicated, I was happy doing what I was doing, and I was a liberal arts major at BMI. And the joke was always that we liberal arts majors, all the engineering people were in lab all afternoon. We LA liberal arts majors, we were on the football stadium sunning ourselves in the afternoons. So, and engineering was foreign to me. Math and science, not my fortes in school. And so a gentleman for the Convention and Visitors Bureau in New York City, who I worked with, called me up and said, AIME, the American Institute of Mining, Metallurgical, and Petroleum Engineers, is looking for a meetings manager. And he said, I've recommended you for the job. And I said, who are they? What are they? And he said, and I said, well, I said, I don't know anything about engineering. I wouldn't be interested in that. And he said to me, you probably don't have to know. He said, they just need a meetings manager. And their 100th anniversary is coming up in 1971. This was 1970 then. And so he said, do me a favor, go on the interview. So, and I'll admit, I went on the interview, and the executive director of AIME, Joe Alford at the time, interviewed me, and he had an apartment on Beekman Place in New York City. And their offices were at First Avenue and 47th Street, looking over the UN, and I was impressed. And it was They made me a very attractive offer eventually, and I thought, gee, this could be kind of neat. Mm-hmm. It's the flip of the coin.
Yeah.
I go from selling the convention and the salesman to being the buyer.
Right.
And I can now, and I thought, I think I could like that side a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end, I decided to join them. And as I just indicated, it was their 100th anniversary was a year and a half away, and they needed somebody to start planning for that major event, because they were founded in 1871, and this was now 1971.
And did you? I imagine you sold your work experience as the seller on the hotel side. You knew what hotels could and could not offer, and that maybe was an advantage for you flipping over.
Exactly right. I knew how to negotiate a good contract, a good a room rate, and knowing the facilities.
Right.
And I would say, you mentioned a word earlier, I think I have to jump back at VMI and whatnot. When you're there in that kind of a military environment, organizational skills are the number one thing.
Right.
Being on time, knowing, you know, getting yourself together,
yep,
being prepared,
right,
and all those kinds of things, but organization. And I like that. I like to be organized.
Right.
I think that's what stood me in good stead through my whole career.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you joined right out of the gate, because you had this, I imagine, a daunting task of preparing for this meeting.
Yes.
And getting up a little bit up to speed on what this institution was. Could you, reflecting back, talk a little bit about where AIME was at the time? And I imagine they were telling you what this was about and what it was supposed to mean on their 100th anniversary.
Yes, it certainly was a milestone event for the Institute. There's going to be a lot we'll talk about about the Institute, as I refer to it as AIME, being in 1971. They had met. Their annual meeting was a group annual meeting of all of the then three societies, mining, metallurgy, and petroleum, met together in every other year in New York City.
Yeah.
And it was a big event. It had been since they were founded. They were founded in New York City.
Yeah.
So those events were big, and in comparison to the time. So there was a big technical meeting of all these different disciplines, and then probably the major event, they wanted to have it wasn't even going to be black tie, it was white tie and tails.
Wow.
Dinner at the New York Hilton, and we had just over 2,000 people. We filled the ballroom and the balcony, and all the luminaries of the past came out from the different disciplines for the event. And I really don't remember what the attendance was. I'm sure it was maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people, probably, at the time. And it was a lot of protocol and fol-de-rol and whatever.
Yeah.
And it was exciting for me to do. But there was a great staff there that knew how to do things, and I was always I liked the protocol.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of formality in those days. Less and less today, but in those days there was a lot of formality to how you did things, and the head table would be marched into music and et cetera, things like that. And so there was a routine to be followed, and I could relate to that coming out of a military kind of a background a little bit, that I found that was had a good purpose and should be maintained.
A real culture. I mean, it sounds kind of glamorous too. It's 100th anniversary, so I imagine it would have to have an element of that. I imagine another feature of this too, as AIME is no longer in New York City, and I understand that a lot of the American mining companies or the U.S.-based mining companies used to be based in New York City. It was really more centralized. Was that the case? That's why AIME was there?
Yes, indeed. I think I always said, in retrospect, looking back, when I joined AME in 1971, that annual meeting, the 100th anniversary, was probably the end of an era for AIME. From then on, at board meetings and board decisions were made at the AME level and then at the member society level to decentralize. That became the key word within the Institute, decentralization. Mm-hmm. And over the next 10 years and less, 5 to 10 years, AME decentralized into 4 autonomous, separately incorporated member organizations, or 3, then it became 4 later. And they were then, first they were given their own control of their own budgets, control of their own membership, and of all those things. And AIME became, had the awards, and pretty much that was it. Mm-hmm. And so that the societies then, because of the attraction and the need to be in New York, as you've indicated, the costs of operating in New York were an issue. The members, for whatever reasons, didn't want to come to New York for board meetings and things of that nature even. So all of the member societies relocated out of New York in the 70s. Hmm. And the Mining Society ended up in Denver. The TMS and Iron and Steel Society ended up in Pittsburgh. And Petroleum had always had offices in Dallas area. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it became this decentralization of the Institute. And the societies had this, the old time members still related to AIME, but the newer members and whatnot all started to become more related to support for the individual member societies and the different technological areas that we covered.
Right. So I imagine it wasn't just a case of the obligation to go to one place, to go to New York, or the centralization. Was there a sense that they had separate needs, they had different problems, and that they were best served by having their own community? So the petroleum engineers didn't feel, or maybe never felt, a common cause with the other folks?
Yes, I think technologically there was some linkages that became less so. I think there became a pride in their areas of technology. The people had, the members had. So the societies kind of grew apart in that sense. Yeah. But there also was, and I don't mind saying it, there were economic issues, mm-hmm, for each of the organizations that were a factor. Mm-hmm. And even within the organization I was in, TMS, there were divisions within that,
right,
that were good and bad.
Right, right.
But I would say TMS was maybe a microcosm of the whole Institute in the sense that the different societies really were going in different directions. Their leadership wanted to have some independence about that, about their organization. Mm-hmm. And all that was probably good.
Yeah.
I think we all 4 societies today have grown and grew, have grown faster and better being separate.
Right, right. So you were at AIME, but you just mentioned this transition to, mm-hmm, to TMS. Can you talk about how that happened?
Yes. Well, when we began all these decentralizations of the societies, the AIME headquarters was reduced in size. And the Mining Society offered me a job to come down and be their meetings manager, mm-hmm, with the mining group. And I did that for about a year. And then the Metallurgical Society at the time made me an offer to come over to their society and be assistant executive director, mm-hmm, and meetings manager. And so that was a little better opportunity for me. They were still in New York City, where I lived and had been married and was starting a family. Mm-hmm. So that fit. So I thought, well, that was a little better position. And I joined TMS then it was around 1973, I think.
And was it called TMS then? Because you mentioned that they're the metallurgists.
Right.
And they had been an organization since 57, is that
correct?
Right? Okay.
They were, the AIME established the societies in 1957, and it's kind of a little bit stranger, lack of a better word, cute. I mean, there was a Society of Mining Engineers, there was a Society of Petroleum Engineers, and then there was the Metallurgical Society, and they all had to have three initials. So they renamed it the Metallurgical Society, so it was TMS, SMESPE.
Right.
And it just fit.
Right.
Okay. So that's how it got the T, and everybody asked me that question for years. Well, what's the T stand for? It's the, and so on. So so that's how it evolved, and then I started with them in those capacities. As I indicated earlier, there always was TMS at the time, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, had three or four divisions.
Mm-hmm.
Even those divisions were not as compatible as they could have been.
Right.
And really the bigger one was the Iron and Steel Division, which that eventually, I think in 74 or 75, somewhere in there, I don't remember the exact year, became its own separate society from TMS.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that was because the other divisions of TMS were more academic and more research oriented, still are to this day. And the Iron and Steel Group was much more industrial.
Yeah.
And they would, there wasn't the compatibility in what they met and what they talked about at meetings technologically.
Mm-hmm.
And the Iron and Steel Group was very defined, more narrowly defined. And I always like to say that TMS was everything from A to Z, aluminum to zinc, and extremely diversified.
Right.
And that's a weakness and a great strength. And I think it's a weakness in how you run and organize the organization, but it's a strength in good times and bad times when, now, honestly, the Petroleum Society has done extremely well. The Mining Society has done, had some ups and downs, but done well. Iron and Steel Society has done well overall, AIST now.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's a down market in steel, they hurt
a
little bit with revenue and membership. Where with TMS, we, you know, if copper was up or some of the extractive industries were down, and then we got involved with some of the new high-tech materials that came into being, it really made a difference in that the society could then sustain some of those little ups and downs better than some of the others could.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end, that's how the whole four societies kind of evolved into being.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said earlier, the move out of New York became more economic-driven and image-driven.
Yeah, and in TMS, was it just a one M? Because they added M's, or was it M's from the beginning?
It was 19, I think 89, pretty sure that's it, that we became the Minerals, Metals, and Materials Society.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that was to accommodate different groups within the organization, that the minerals was to be the more extractive side that related to the mining society, and the metals was some of the more functional metal areas, if you call, and the materials side of it was where the society saw potential growth.
Right.
And materials became, and I'm going to use the expression probably a few times, if I jump ahead, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
We kind of mirrored, TMS mirrored different things within the profession and within the industry. The materials advent in the name, I think, kind of mirrored what was happening at universities.
Yeah.
Metallurgical engineering departments are becoming material science and engineering departments.
Right.
And they kind of led the way.
Yeah.
And because we have a high percent of professors and academicians in TMS, that became, they wanted that to be recognized in their professional society's name.
Right.
So it just was obvious. Mm-hmm. And it was it wasn't without some pain and some study and some whatever, mm-hmm. but the name was changed, and it's kind of like blah, blah, blah. But and people still stumble over it a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think it makes sense.
It does.
And it probably has stood the society. It probably has stood it good and stood it. It stood up well in it being able to grow and evolve the way it has.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably no coincidence that it's 1973 that you're joining this the TMS, and there's this recognition of this need for decentralization. This is also a time of crisis in the U.S. and global economy. Mm-hmm. I imagine that played into it. There's a bit of a down market in a number of the industries, and that affected the fortune, the relative fortunes of the societies as they went through the 1970s a little bit.
Yes, I would say my recollections are that the 70s were certainly at tougher times for the organization. I've already said we were going through a relocation from New York City to Pittsburgh. We were going through a change in our name. We were going through changes in our whole divisional structure. I mean, TMS had, I'm trying to think of, I should be able to think of a good psychological term for this. We had sort of a, we didn't know whether we went through a period where we had multiple divisions, mm-hmm. then we decided we want to be this homogeneous organization, mm-hmm. and the divisions were a problem. We got rid of the divisions. We're just one organization with 35 to 40 technical committees,
wow.
you know, with no structure that they related to a division structure as
right.
we had. Like they were like mini societies. Mm-hmm. And then after a few years, that didn't work so well, so we said, let's recreate divisions, which we did. Then in the early 80s, and so on. So those factors in those years, I would say there were a couple of other things that come to mind. Mm-hmm. The industry in America was changing, and TMS, and you've probably heard this from the other societies when you get into that, the big major corporations were dissolving and breaking up, and so our members, or the people who were joining the society, weren't coming from the big corporations anymore. Our leadership wasn't from the big corporations so much anymore. Much more with smaller companies. Mm-hmm. That was then impacted in the 80s and 90s, jumping a little bit ahead, mm-hmm. but late 80s into the 90s. Again, a reflection with universities. The universities in graduate school, particularly in metals and materials, had an influx of foreign students mm-hmm. from outside the U.S. almost in dominating position.
Yeah.
And they were becoming members. Mm-hmm. So our society was evolving, growing into much more of an international organization. And our members were coming into smaller companies, startup companies, newer companies. And those, the other companies, the big corporations, they used to, you know, have a career plan for their people. Mm-hmm. Didn't exist anymore.
Right.
People had to become more responsible mm-hmm. individually for their own career development. And that, I think, was a boon to TMS and a professional society if it responded properly to those needs and what we would be about in trying to assist and help our members, you know, through their career evolution and development.
Yeah.
And I think TMS has done a pretty good job of that. Always could be better, mm-hmm. but I think it's done a pretty good job of that. So the bigger to the smaller companies and the international impact, I think, I know in those time periods that I was there, 40-some percent of our new members we got up to each year. We came from outside the United States in the late 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think today, the membership in the society is somewhere close to 30 or 35% from outside the United States.
I think one other commenter mentioned 42%.
Maybe. I wouldn't know.
I think that was the, I don't know, maybe they checked the statistics for just recently. But yeah, it's a significant membership. And this is something that you wrote an article I'm speaking of jumping ahead, in the mid 90s, and you talked about this same process, the same evolution, that by then there was membership from 77 different countries, mm-hmm. and it was already 33% members who are from outside of the United States.
Right.
And that's a reflection of globalization of these industries as well. So mining and metallurgy is happening in these other places.
And I'll go back one
sure.
thing came to mind if I can. Mm-hmm. I think also what was happening at the time was a lot of companies were moving offshore, developing offshore activities, at the same time, a lot of the other more developed countries, Europe, Asia in particular, were becoming much more competitive with the United States in their research and development. Mm. And TMS membership and our leadership, the members, and our boards, recognized that. And we developed some specific plans for that. And I think one of the really positive and right things that TMS did. A number of organizations, American societies, associations, they were, you know, rah-rah the U.S., we'll evolve, but we'll create many societies around the world. Fine, that's your decision, and you can do it, good. TMS made a very serious and I want to use the words more calculated decision. We weren't going to do that. We were going to build a cooperative relationship with our counterpart societies around the world. And that was kind of unique for me in the job that I had and some of our leaders, and a gentleman we'll come back to, Keith Brimacombe, coming to mind now.
Yeah, sure.
He was very enthused and a leader in getting us to become more internationally involved. So I got to travel with various society presidents and build cooperative relationships, as was evidenced, I think, last night at our dinner we just had here. There were 8 or 10 at least counterpart societies that were in attendance, and they come to our meeting, and we meet, and we decide to do joint conferences and joint activities with them. And it's really been a win-win for both of our societies. And mm-hmm. we have now exchange student individuals that go and lecture with Japan, the Japanese societies, mm-hmm. and a couple of others.
Yeah.
So that I think is another part of the impacts and the trends that were happening in those times that really were quite impactful on TMS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's with all of the confusion socially and economically and politically in the 1970s, it must have been, in retrospect, that's what happened. But do you recall a point when it occurred to people that things were changing in the world and that TMS needed to react? Or was it an ongoing process of adaptation?
Yeah, I can't say off the top of my head I could pinpoint. It was a little more evolutionary, mm-hmm. probably, for us. I think one of the issues that's we're prideful in saying we're a member-run organization, not staff-managed, staff-run. The decisions of the members are, they make the decisions and yep. the staff implements. Mm-hmm. And I will go back. It was later than that, honestly, but it was sort of maybe done more informally with strategic planning. Mm-hmm. It was much more informal in those times you're just referring to. It came later where we really recognized the need for that mm-hmm. And how we would guide and direct the future of our organization. Mm-hmm. But it just evolved with everything. And I think one of the things that maybe helped us it's maybe not quite on point, but because the big corporations were dissolving and things were moving offshore, our membership, and particularly the leadership of the society, got younger and younger. Mm-hmm. And people like my age, the 60, well, I'm older than that, the 60-some-year-old CEOs that used to be on our board of directors and the only ones when I first started weren't there anymore. And we were getting, you know, 50-year-olds and 40-year-olds.
Right.
And those individuals, because of that, I think their world was different in where they worked and where their careers were and where the technology was. So I think that maybe helped TMS in the sense that we were already there.
Right.
And we weren't having to, that wasn't going to come and surprise us, you know, 5 years from now.
Right.
We were living it through our leadership and through our membership that was having that experience.
There was a generational shift in
exactly.
the 1970s.
Well put.
Yeah.
It definitely was a generational shift, and it's continued to this day,
yeah.
in my opinion.
Yeah.
When I sit here now and look at our board of directors, and even looking at some of the award recipients last night, I was saying, oh, now I know I'm older. They look really young to me, and they are.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, a really good thing.
Yeah. And you can see the need. The nature of the work, I mean, these are, when you think of engineering and you think of material science and you think there's such a demand for it, it's such a high growth area in the economy, the layman probably looks at that and thinks, what a stable job,
mm-hmm.
what a stable career to have. But what you're describing is there's a lot of fluctuation. When there's a downturn, an economic downturn, there are folks turned out of work. There are barriers to entry for students who mm-hmm. want to transition and get their first job. And so there is this mediating and mitigating force, I suppose, that TMS serves in that workforce to respond to the needs as they change almost on a year-by-year basis because of this of these fluctuations. Now, I guess the other side of that is that the TMS suffers and enjoys growth along with that, and so that's one of the burdens. But it's kind of it seems to kind of exert a kind of moderating influence on the I don't want to say the job market is too narrow, but
yeah.
it seems to have a really positive influence on ongoing career development even in a time of economic crisis. And that was its ability to sort of adapt to these new challenges was really, really important for the society and for the members. Can you talk a little bit about people? Because you came into this, you came into the society without knowing too much about the work that these folks did. Can you talk about people who helped you and influenced you in your directorship of the TMS?
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate your asking that question because I think it's probably a little trite to say, but you certainly you owe a lot to a lot of people in any career, in life in general,
right.
per se. And I will tell you, and again, I'll make excuses for myself that I can't name everybody. But there were a handful or a number of people, I think, that really had an impact on me. And I guess I would say what I tried to do is think of a few people that I really learned something from in my career that helped me then be a better staff person, executive director for the society. When I started in 1973, Julius Harwood, who just passed away last year, was at Ford Motor Company for a number of years. He was the president of the society. And it was interesting to me that he talked about he was big into the art of negotiation, and because he was then at that time period facing all this divisional disputes that we were having in the society, and he needed to focus on that. So I learned how to be a pretty good negotiator with his work. In 1991, Ron Miller became our president. He was with Alcoa, and he was really big into data. And he would say to me, "Alex, get the data before we make a decision so we know what we're doing." Mm. 95, I think back to Paul Campbell. Paul Campbell, again, happened to be with Alcoa, but Paul was from South Carolina, and he had all that Southern good old boy charm. But he was big on keeping certain issues in front of us. And mm-hmm. he said, focus on an issue at a time and handle that. Mm-hmm. 97, a gentleman I still remain friends with, Rob Wagoner. I usually pick one word for Rob, it would be decisive. Rob was always one that he would do your research, make your decision, and move on, mm-hmm. Whatever. 98 was Ewell Cutshaw. Ewell, again, an Alcoa person. But it was Ewell's job in that year. And this is probably when I mentioned earlier where we really got into strategic planning.
Yeah.
And Ewell was one of the instigators of that. And he toughed it out in writing a new mission statement. If anybody thinks writing a mission statement is easy, it ain't. Whatever.
Well, can we pause for a moment on that? And Ewell, it's an interesting name, E-U-E-L-L, and Cutshaw, C-U-T-S-H-A-L-L. The strategic planning and the mission statement. At the end of the 90s, why was that considered to be an important thing to do for TMS?
Yes, it was extremely important, I think, and I think it's been a real asset to the society to have done that. We had strategic plans of some sort in the past, but it's trite to say, mm-hmm. We'd write them and we'd put them in a loose leaf notebook and we'd put them on the shelf and nobody ever looked at them, including myself hardly. And then I think it would be in one of the years, it was Milt Wadsworth when he started a review system with me as executive director. He wanted me to write out goals for the year that I had to personally accomplish. It sounds like something you should be doing all the time, right. But you know. And so honestly, that started with the germ, if you will, the genesis of having a strategic plan, because mm-hmm. I then developed some certain goals for myself and they really involved the organization. Mm-hmm. So, and then I would say TMS at that time, we had been on our own for a while. As a separate society, we were separately incorporated, and we had okay financial years, but we realized at that point in time we needed to run the society, and I'm going to say it, we are not for profit, 501c3, but we had to run it like a business.
Yeah.
And we had to bring in business approach to things and learning and understanding how to price our products and services and how to marketing. We hired a marketing manager person on staff for the first time, I think, in that period of time, and got a CPA to be our business manager, mm-hmm. which we hadn't had before. Nothing wrong with what we were doing, just wasn't as sophisticated, again, as it could be. So the strategic planning, and I know, was begun right in that time period, and we agonized over it, as most organizations do. But we made it a point that they weren't going to be just put on a shelf. So we had that so that staff were reviewed based upon progress of the strategic plan. And we had it where we reviewed it at board meetings. Mm-hmm. We had 3 board meetings a year. We'd give the status report on certain things. And we'd set rather specific, just common practice, goals and see if they weren't being accomplished or, mm-hmm. you know, or put on the back burner and come back to again.
Right.
So I would say strategic planning and all the ramifications of how that filters down into an organization became really an important lifeblood of the society.
Right.
And remains so today. And I see it in the journals. They publish the announcements on that. They have signage up around the big annual meeting of what the five, I think, are five main strategic goals are today, and it's a way of doing business that makes a lot of sense. But you've got to keep awareness of it and
right.
keep and hold people's feet to the fire
right.
that they're focusing on that and they're not off left or right,
right.
doing something that's not contributing to that
right.
goal.
And transparency and communication so that the members
yes.
are aware of this is what we're doing and constant constant appraisal.
And another thing that's really important and I learned, the strategic plan does a wonderful thing for a member organization like ours. We get a new president every year. We get a third of the board is new every year. We have new committee chairs all the time. And if you don't have a ongoing strategic plan, you get people in there who either want to do something not in the plan or don't know what to do or whatever. But here's the plan. Here's what you need to focus on. And it creates much more of a continuum and much more of a focus. And I think really helps the volunteer members in acquitting themselves and really making the right contribution mm-hmm. To the society.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify the structure, it's run with an endowment, is that right? Does it have an endowment and then there's revenue from the endowment that is used for the operating budget?
No. We have an operating budget that's built on revenue and expense for the year.
Okay, so that's different. Yeah. So I think some other societies have
right.
Have endowments.
Right. Our endowment, we have a reserve fund
okay.
for a rainy day fund, or what do you call it that? Mm-hmm. But the endowment, if you will, what I would refer to is part of the TMS Foundation,
okay.
which is separate from the society.
Right.
The money is separate from the society. The society still board still controls that because
mm-hmm.
it's not a separately incorporated foundation,
okay.
which is a little unique or not so unique, but
okay.
but whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the society runs on an operating budget now, which is just past $7 million a year of revenue and expense.
Right.
And the business plan is to have X percent surplus, we don't call it a profit,
mm-hmm.
X percent surplus per year.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been successful in doing that.
Mm-hmm. And during over the decades, you talked about sort of down times for the society. Were there lots of fluctuations in membership? So people would be, I don't know, out of work, or they would drop their membership. Were there significant fluctuations, or was it much
yeah,
less?
No, I honestly, there weren't significant fluctuations. There would be stagnation, I guess I'll
right.
call it, where we weren't growing. We didn't have much growth. I know in my 37 years working for the society, I'm pretty sure there was only 1 year, and I think I'm accurate in that, where we had an operating loss
right.
of more expense than income for the year. I don't remember the exact year, but it's back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And it was very slow growth for us, but that was odd because then we had in 75, when the Iron and Steel Society split, we lost close to half of our membership
right.
went to another society.
Right.
So we're like starting over a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So there were some events that happened that changed, that impacted those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But fairly, I mean, a long recession, there would be very, very slow growth, but things sort of picked up. Did it track along with the health of the economy?
Yes, it did. But TMS, I would say a society like ours, usually lagged some of that by a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, okay.
Right.
And so maybe then it took us a couple of years to get out of it when industry started to come back.
Right, right. So late 90s, the strategic plan was in place. And there are other institutions. You mentioned the foundation. I don't know when you'd like to talk about that or when that starts.
Okay. I can finish up with these people
yeah,
if you want me to. Do you
sure.
mind my doing that?
No, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
But as I indicated, with Ewell Cutchell in 98 Strategic Planning, then right on the heels of that was 99 and Wayne Jones.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the individuals that could lace humor into major decisions and always had a quick wit and that kind of thing. And I learned that from him, to try and emulate some of that, but I'm not a witty person, as you maybe observe here. In 2000, we had Austin Chang, and Austin was very interested in international protocol. We were then really in the center of trying to develop cooperative relationships with other societies. And Austin was one of those people that I had great respect for from the standpoint, and a lot of our major leaders did, they reinvented themselves from working in one area of technology and could move to another. Not a lot did that, but certainly Austin did. Mm-hmm. 2002, John Allison. John was a Ford guy at the time, and he was always prepared, and he had some difficult times with some negotiations that we had to do with other societies. What
was the nature of negotiations with other societies, roughly speaking?
Other domestic societies.
Okay.
And I would, with ASM International, mm-hmm. MRS, were certainly at some level competing organizations. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to do cooperative things with them. Mm-hmm. And they were some touchy and difficult negotiation.
Yeah.
To protect the best interests of our society.
Yeah. And because as an outsider, I am curious about the existence of ASM and it's the Materials Research Society.
Correct, MRS.
Yeah. So why are there these other societies? Do you have any insight on that?
With MRS, they are. I would maybe define them as being more high tech and more physicist. Mm-hmm. They have a high degree of physicist membership in it, and they, to their credit, they had a very unique system of running conferences and how they attracted papers for their conferences and that, I'll say it, better than TMS at the time they started up. I think we're as good or better than them now, mm-hmm. but they were that way. With ASM, they were a very old organization that were at a more of a lower technical level, mm-hmm. for lack of a better, nicer way of saying it. And they were established, I think, in some of the steel and automotive side of things, if I recollect it correct.
Oh, so it's the Association of Steel?
No. They had another name prior to that,
okay.
And so they were very industry oriented,
right?
Or industry, academic and research was not their thing,
right?
And one of the reasons to work with ASM, and I think it's worked well, we do, the society does, is that we bring a different side of membership, and mm-hmm. they bring another side, and getting the two to talk together. It always was an issue of getting industry to talk to research, mm-hmm. and academic. Mm-hmm. And there was always that kind of battle.
And that seemed to be more urgent and more in the air in the 1990s. I think in the 1996 article that you wrote, mm-hmm. you talked about one of the features of the 90s was the collapse of defense R&D,
yes.
and government funding,
right.
for the kind of, that was the bread and butter for a lot of folks
indeed.
In those in those societies,
right.
And so you were identifying the role of TMS as a new or renewed resource,
mm-hmm.
for those members, that they could begin to do more networking, bringing industry in a bit more. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, that would be true. It's always been a goal for TMS to try and get more industry involved. It's been a tough battle.
Yeah.
But they're always working at it and should be. And I think it has improved and over time. Mm-hmm. But bridging those two or three worlds is what I think is great about TMS. We can be that bridge between academia, research, and industry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so returning to the early 2000s now, I keep stopping you from describing the people, but those people are important. So if you can continue talking about those folks, that would be great.
Right. And 2003, I had one of the fun people I had to work with Dan Toma. I would say about Dan was passion. He had a passion for the technology, and he was always he was an optimist, but he had it laced with a little bit of reality of what he could do, but it was pretty good. And 2004, that was probably a unique year, because Teresa Pollack was our first female president, long time in coming, and Teresa was really about the needs of the next generation and certainly student members, but she probably was a great example of how far women in our profession had come and could come. 2006, Brijinder Mishra, he had a real passion also, but it was he always looked at the important opportunities and really wanted to focus on get things done for the society. He was the last direct president that I got to work with. So in looking at all of those, some of these individuals here that I've just been able to mention, these are the things that I learned that helped from them, that helped me really be a better executive director for them. I want to return a little bit to the women's side. I never quite understood. We fought that battle. We had a lot of growth in women, females, in our student membership. I think materials science, that side of it, is what people like to talk about as a clean technology, laboratory work, research work, academic environment that could be more attractive to females than some other engineering groups maybe would be. And we had a lot, but we never quite transitioned that, the percent we had in academia in university level, into becoming members. And there were lots of issues. I don't need to get into them, but maybe people thought that. I mean, they married, they had family, they did other things that interrupted their careers. But I think that is probably, I believe that is changing now. I don't know, have any data to give you, but I think that is settled down somewhat now. But even the walking the halls of this meeting, you don't see the percent of females that you would think you would see today.
There's an ongoing challenge in growing the proportion of women in science and engineering professions. It's a much studied issue that we won't be able to resolve in this interview. But suffice it to say that they're still trying to study the problem and understand, you know, the leakage from the pipeline, right? As they, you know, they're getting more and more students in, but keeping women in the engineering professions is a challenge, and getting them to senior ranks, which is why Dr. Pollack's story is so important.
Right.
I think
I was just going to comment to you. I think when you get to do the interview with Teresa Pollack, you'll find that's something you can focus on with her, and I would hope and expect she will have some pretty good insight into that for you.
Absolutely. And so that comes to the end of your time. Can you talk about your transition and stepping down? When did that happen?
Yeah, I'd like to come back to that. I'm looking at notes that I have here, honestly.
Sure.
And I thought there's one other area I think that's been a huge impact, probably on all professional societies, but certainly TMS, and that was the advent of the technological stuff with the internet, with electronic communication, and those kinds of things. I would say if there was anything besides the advent of computers, and I'll admit my ignorance of those things, when we first got them in TMS, we looked at the budget, and we thought, okay, we'll put a computer on everybody's desk, and wow, you know, and I thought, okay, we'll do that, we'll spend whatever the money was, and we're done.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 2 years later, the people come to me and say, well, we have to update these things. Update what, you know? And I didn't know what we, but any event. But technology, when you stop and think about it today with electronic communication, mm-hmm. for an organization like a TMS, it's changed the whole whatever of how the organization is done. Mm-hmm. Because years back we had our program committee, we had like 20 or 25 people in the program. They'd come to the TMS headquarters, they'd spend 2-3 days trying to organize all the papers for this annual meeting. Mm-hmm. They'd sit around a room and have paper, you know, charts up there and listing papers and putting file cards on under them with what papers were going to be in what session.
Right.
It's done like that electronically today. Everybody working at their own place where they live and work, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't have to come to a meeting, and we have a whole programming system on the computer now that just does it all, and it can manipulate all that stuff. It's a phenomenal, that side of it. The other side is the publication of papers and books electronically. Mm-hmm. And what that's done, I think TMS, to its credit, has really, because we have, and I always thought that was luck, mm-hmm. more than luck, because our membership is in research and academia, mm-hmm. they were aware of the electronic communications and the internet and email before half of the world.
Yeah.
And they brought us, they expected us to have that.
Yeah.
And that was, thankfully, a blessing in disguise,
yeah.
for the society.
Yeah.
So I think that was an important impact in my tenure with the society near the end of it. That really came to the fore, and I think today is just the way it's done.
Yeah.
And so you really need to, you know, think about that. So.
It is astonishing how quick TMSonline.org went online in 93, something like that.
Probably, yeah.
I think that was in the 96 article you wrote about the importance of the internet in 1996.
Yeah.
So you were really. The society and you were really on top of that as a developer.
And I don't mean to sound, but I feel it's important to say, the other member societies within TMS, and I'll name it, with the mining group and even the steel group, I don't think petroleum so much, mm-hmm. they didn't see the need for that. The industrial-related societies as early as we did. They do now, and they have, you know, brought that all up. But at first it was like, what are you doing, you know?
Right.
And why are you doing that, you know? Why are you spending money on that?
Yeah.
And how does that work, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And I think that was true of with what you're doing with all the different society associations in engineering fields.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of them probably were more in the forefront mm-hmm. of that.
And that's, some people, with the rise of the digital age, some people talk about downsides too.
Yeah.
And I think there's some anxiety at TMS about the new generation or the so-called digital natives and the new younger people and their relationship to a face-to-face meeting society.
Yeah.
And so do you have any reflections on that?
It's nice. We can probably bookend our whole interview here. Being what I like to talk to myself about, and it's being more of a people person, mm-hmm. I would place high value on the interpersonal relationships and a face-to-face meeting. Just this interview with you, I'll say it, I've enjoyed it immensely. Not sure I was, but I have. You know, just the pressure of something.
Sure,
like this.
Sure.
So I think having face-to-face meetings, and every time we do a survey of TMS members, the number one thing that they like about the society and like about is the interpersonal relationships they have is the networking.
Right.
And now networking, honestly, can happen, you know, via the internet and phone and whatever else. But in my mind, there's nothing like being able to sit down with a colleague and over a cup of coffee or whatever it might be and talk about the issues that you have and assist each other in working on the technological problems or whatever the situation is. Mm-hmm. So I think the personal relationship, I guess I'll use that word, a personal relationship is important. How that happens maybe is okay, but I think having very regular face-to-face meetings is always going to be important. I think we as human beings are have that innate need.
Yeah.
I hope we do.
Yeah.
And I hope it continues, and that the internet and those things don't destroy that for future generations. But I think I've done some research recently, just not deep research, for our foundation that I'm on now, about millennials and how they relate,
right,
and how they want to be contacted and want to be solicited for donations, and what they expect if they give money to an organization. They want to see where it went. They want to see something happen from it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is a little different. And they don't want to be contacted with a solicitation letter. An email is fine, you know, or something electronic is fine that they can respond to instantaneously, you know, and not put it to pay with their bills at the end of the month, you know, kind of thing.
Exactly.
So it's that's what I think is exciting about the world and about life, and about running, being part of a professional technical society like a TMS. Mm-hmm. It is always changing, but it is people.
Yeah.
And it's people first. And you've got to, get a little whatever here. You got to love the people, and you got to be able to have some empathy for them, and to really, as staff people for organizations like that, you've got to have that. And one of the things I always look for when I was hiring people, I try to look for somebody who had a service attitude, a service orientation, and were comfortable, but wanted to do that,
right,
and felt that, and you can't fake it.
Right.
You got to be able to do that.
That's
and
right.
So I think in all that sense. And you asked about, you know, go back to your question about winding down here. My career.
Well,
whatever.
Before we do that, there is something related, and that is the development of the TMS Foundation. Could you talk about that? We didn't quite cover that. So.
Yes. Thank you. Would want to have that opportunity. One of the people I didn't mention who was a strong influence in my career was Keith Brimacombe. Keith was our president in 1993, I believe. Mm-hmm. Is it right? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But any event, Keith was unique in the fact that he was probably the only person yet, and probably may ever be, that was president of TMS and then Iron and Steel Society, now AIST. And Keith had an ability, he had the vision thing, and it's easy to say but hard to define, but he had a vision thing, and he always wanted to move forward with whatever he was involved with doing, and one of the fun things that brings a smile to my face now is he'd say to me, Alex, when he was in vice president and president, past president, he'd say, come on, Alex, we're going to have a little natter. And I said, what is a natter, you know? And I knew, I looked it up in the dictionary. And it's, I guess it's a British expression that means have a little conversation, a little discussion, a little whatever. Any event, we were at Banff, Lake Louise, in Canada at a meeting. And he said, come here, Alex, we're going to have a little natter. Let's take a walk around Lake Louise. Now, this is the atmosphere, you know, it's like phenomenal. And I'm like, okay, what's Keith going to come up with now? You know, I had a little bit of that attitude. We're walking along the lakeside, and we walked all the way up to the headwaters of it, I think, and back. You can't walk quite around it. And he said, I have an idea for a foundation. I don't understand why TMS doesn't have a foundation. And I know how foundations work, and I know what good they can do. And as a professional society, we have so much we could do and give back to future generations. And his expression to me at that time, and still works for me today, is pass the torch. Mm-hmm. He says, as professional people, we need to pass the torch to the next generation and the next generation. So it was his concept to have a foundation for the society. He brought that forward with a lot of background work and how to structure that and those kinds of things to the board, and that was eventually approved, and implemented. We have had our difficulties with it, definitely, for TMS. But I think in the last couple of years, Rob Wagoner and Diron Apelian and several other people, Marty Glicksman, I want to name those people because they have been big supporters of it. Can't think of his first name. Wadsworth with
Milton
Patel.
Wadsworth, yeah.
Pardon?
Milton Wadsworth?
No. Jeffrey Wadsworth. Wadsworth.
Okay.
Maybe you can edit that.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Wadsworth with Patel. Uh-huh. They've been really instrumental in getting the vision thing again.
Yeah.
And being able to convey, and that's the hard thing, convey that vision to other people.
Yeah.
And get other people to see that, buy into that, mm-hmm. and then support it.
Yeah.
So I think the foundation is, we use the big word revitalized, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We've been working at that for almost 2 years now. Mm-hmm. And it's showing renewed life mm-hmm. and purpose and those good things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I was approached 2 years ago now. I've been retired 8 years, excuse me, just 8 this year,
mm-hmm.
To give back.
Yeah.
And I remembered Keith Brimacombe, and I remembered, you know, Pass the Torch,
mm-hmm.
and I thought TMS, and I want to say this, TMS was very good to me.
Mm-hmm.
My family has benefited from my being able to have a career with them,
mm-hmm.
and I felt to give back.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can do that. I felt I have something I could contribute to the foundation and helping it get reborn
mm-hmm.
and change a little and find a new lease on life in what it does.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I've been about with working with them and why I'm actually here at the meeting mm-hmm. today.
Yeah, and it sounds like, I mean, you have been recognized for your service, have you not? Isn't there a...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, it was a surprise, but they established before I think it was around for distinguished member of
Distinguished Service Award.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yeah. Correct. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
the TMS Distinguished Service Award. They mm-hmm. renamed it in my name,
mm.
and I was humbled by it, honored by it, and it's pretty neat because I look whoever gets it every year, and there's something to be said to see your own name on something that you expect will be there for posterity.
Mm-hmm.
And just last night at the awards thing, you hear about awards that were established in 1933 or 1972 or back in the earlier 1900s, you know, and here we are in 2015, you know,
yeah.
to think that that goes on and for the people that were involved and,
mm-hmm.
and the distinguished list. So,
yeah.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up.
It's a recognition that TMS sees that you've been an important part of the history of the institution over these decades,
mm-hmm.
and you continue to be of service.
Yes.
So, I want to thank you for taking the time to sit down to speak with us.
Well, it was a privilege, and I really enjoyed it.
Wonderful.